Welcome to Excess Returns, where we focus on what works over the long term in the markets. Join us as we talk about the strategies and tactics that can help you become a better long-term investor.
Justin Carbonell and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.
Hey guys, this is Justin. In this Show's Your Portfolio episode, Jack and I sit down with Andrew Beer, co-founder of Dynamic Beta Investments and co-portfolio manager of one of the more popular managed future ETFs on the market today. We sit down with Andrew to discuss his personal portfolio and approach to investing, to how he thinks about money, wealth, and what is important, to the use of managed futures and deriving returns from assets that are uncorrelated with stocks and bonds. Andrew brings a thoughtful and distinctive approach to managing his portfolio while also emphasizing the importance of giving back while actively participating in charitable endeavors that are important to him. As always, thank you for listening. Please enjoy this discussion with Dynamic Beta Investments, Andrew Beer. Andrew, thank you very much for joining us today and coming back.
Thank you so much for having me, guys. Great to see you.
Your last episode was very popular with our listeners and subscribers. And so I think people will definitely get a lot of enjoyment and sort of knowledge out of this one. And we're not going to focus so much on managed futures and investment strategy, although I think that'll naturally work its way into the conversation. But we wanted to have you on to talk about sort of your personal portfolio and how you manage your portfolio and how you think about your own strategies at the personal level and what investors can hopefully learn from that. So, you know, very much appreciate your time. Welcome back to Connecticut, by the way.
Thank you very much. Great to be back.
So we always like to start out like kind of a financial planner would, which is when you're thinking about your long-term goals and what you're trying to achieve with your investments, how do you capture what you're trying to do?
So I'm actually not great at thinking long-term, I'll have to tell you. I think what I've, because I've always viewed my portfolio as having both things that are economic and things that are very non-economic. And we talked briefly about homeownership, right? For me, homeownership has never been about, to a fault, right? Because, I mean, there are people who buy the house that they love, but they also know to buy it in the right place and it appreciates enormously over time. Look at anybody who bought homes in Miami, for instance, right? Looks like an absolute genius today. I've never had that instinct around certain things like that. It's not in my wiring. It's like, I'm going to live in a house that I want to live in, sort of economics be damned. But I think more broadly, I've also been for 25 years, I've always had my own businesses. And they've always been startups. And so a lot of the capital that I've had has gone into what I do every day. My current business, DBI, I funded it for 10 years. I paid myself and everybody else to come to work for 10 years. And, you know, probably at the end of year four, a lot of people were saying, throw in the towel. At the end of year six, they were saying, definitely throw in the towel. At the end of year eight. And I just, but it wasn't just the economics of it. It's I believed in it. You know, and so to me, in a sense, money and wealth creation is not just about the dollar signs and the number of zeros at the end of some period of time, because I am fortunate in that my mother came from a very wealthy family and there was no correlation between how much those people had when they died and how happy they were when they died. It was much more about the day-to-day fulfillment of what you do. And so, you know, money is complicated in that way.
How do you, and maybe you partly just answered this, but when you think about your, where I'm going to use the word retirement, which, you know, maybe I know we're a long way away from that, but, you know, thinking about retirement and what you want your retirement to look like, I guess it's being happy and fulfilled in whatever you're doing, but what do you ever think of that far out, or are you not really just thinking that way?
I don't think I'm going to know how to retire. I think like it's, you know, my dad is 89 and he's an architect. You know, when he was 84, he was still traveling all over the world. He was building hotels in China and stuff. So look, I think about what I do think about is that there may be a period of time where I can't work. You know, I may have a health issue, an accident, a family issue or something else that causes me not to work. And I want to make sure that under those circumstances, I can live comfortably. But it's not about living extravagantly. I have friends from business school and college who are like, Ken Griffin was in my college class. You know, I've often said, like, having Ken Griffin going to the hedge fund industry, having been Harvard class of 1989, is like becoming a writer and finding out Shakespeare was in your freshman seminar. Like, it's, you know, it's, but I've always taken a different tact. I love what I do. And so money is, in a sense, providing security and stability. And when I think 10 years out or 20 years out, I want, you know, enough to be able to support myself comfortably if I can't work, or I want to do something very different than what I'm doing. I want to make sure there's enough for my wife. If I pass away suddenly, I want to make sure there's enough for my son and daughters, that they're taken care of. But again, not to the point where I would want them to be in a position where they don't have to work for their whole lives.
Yeah, with Ken Griffin in there, you probably have to use the median instead of the mean for the income on that graduating class. Or you might have a distorted value.
No, they did this capital campaign on my 25th anniversary, and they said, you know, as if it was going to put pressure on me, they were like, Ken, I don't know the guy, but Ken gave $100 million. And like, and he did it for all of us.
Exactly.
Gift.
How do you think about, like, you talk about always being involved in startups. Like, we're going to talk about how you manage your public portfolio, but how do you think about how that impacts, like, the way you have to manage your public assets because you're always, you know, doing startup type things on the other side?
So I have a pool of liquid assets. They're not very thoughtfully invested, I will tell you, because when I look at the public world, it's basically long equity indices. And, you know, I've had this long running debate about equities, bonds, asset allocation, all the different tools that people try to maximize returns over time. For me personally, I'm not sure it's worth the effort to, I mean, years ago, I used to have a much more complicated personal portfolio. I didn't find that it added for me that much value over time. For me, my great scarce resource is my personal time. And so the more time that I spend doing that, if I felt absolutely confident, I'm overweight international stocks right now, right? Relative to US stocks. Not been a good thing over the past couple of years, but it wasn't a big call on my part. It's just like instinctively, I think if a market is cheaper, it's probably going to do better over time, but it's not making a huge bet on it one way or the other. I do think equities are the best wealth accumulation asset class you can find. And if you're not worried about month to month or year to year volatility, I mean, of course, the problem with volatility is that for a lot of people, they've made enough money, but if they lose 30 or 40% of their assets, their lives change a lot, right? Now we got to sell the house. We can't pay for our kids' college. You know, it's like that's where it has an impact. But if you have a wealth above a certain level where you think you'll be comfortable under that 30 or 40% drawdown, you don't have to sell. I think equities, it's this great dynamic asset class that I think Warren Buffett got right when he said, you know, the S&P 500 is not there's nothing passive about the S&P 500 because you've got 500 really smart, really hungry, rapacious capitalists who go to work every day, try to figure out how do we make the right capital allocation decisions? How do we execute on it? How do we do these different things? And the more those guys succeed, like a Microsoft or an Apple or Alphabet, the greater percentage of their portfolio are going to be in something like the S&P 500, which is not to say you can't do better than that, but that's a pretty great starting point for wealth accumulation over time, even if you're overpaying by a little bit, even if it's not quite as exciting or interesting as an emerging market allocation today.
How do you think about the diversifier for equities? Because that's been the challenge for a lot of people recently. And as you know, with what you do and the funds you manage, like in 2022, a lot of people learned a very harsh lesson about bonds as the sole diversifier for equities. So like, how do you think about that when you think about diversifying your equity exposure?
So bonds, there's a decent argument today that bonds are useless from a diversification perspective. Here's the argument. And by the way, I apologize for my throat. We've been playing viral ping pong in my house, so I'm at the last stages of this. So I put something up on our website called, is www.dbi.co. And I put something up called the Great 60-40 Head Fake. And what it was, is it talked about a 60-40 portfolio of the S&P 500 and Bloomberg Ag, kind of a broad representation of bonds during the 2010s. And it had three characteristics that converged in a very unusual way. The first was equity returns were ridiculous, right? There's not a person in the world who in 2010 thought the S&P would go up as much as it did, 250% over that period of time. And bonds actually did well. Their returns came down over time, but they were still going up for most of that period of time. The volatility on both came down, right? So that S&P return, like remember end of 2017 where the S&P went up like every day? You know, so the vol on the S&P got crushed and bond vols came down as well. So you had two things that were doing really well, which didn't appear risky. And then if you put them together, they were moving against each other. They were inversely correlated for most of the decade. So the result was, if you look at it on a two-year rolling basis, the volatility of a 60-40 portfolio got down to 4% at one point.
Right? Some of the lowest in history, I think, right?
Exactly, right? It looked perfect. Right? So, and by the way, so we ran a great stat. And by the way, my big project this year, which I think is going to be fun, is every week I'm going to try to put on some chart or something, that a stat that I like that I think is really interesting. And actually, just before I did this, I posted something on what we call as the sea of red and sea of green, that in 2022, this all changed, right? Stocks and bonds went down together. And then this last year, I mean, until end of October, bonds hadn't moved, but equities had gone up. But by the end of the year, all stocks and bond category came up. So we had a sea of red and we had a sea of green. So the two big things that changed are, first is the volatility of both stocks and bonds have gone up a lot. And the second is the correlations flip from negative to positive. So a standard 60-40 portfolio may have the same expected return over the next 10 years, but it's got double or triple the volatility. And so when you look at diversification, most of the 80% of the diversification in a multi-asset portfolio was driven by the inverse correlation between stocks and bonds. Because if you say, I'm going to diversify from equity, from the S&P 500 into international stocks, high correlation. Emerging markets, 80% correlation. I'm going to go into private equity, high correlation. So on my bond side, I say I'm going to go into private credit, high correlation, right? So you had these two clusters in your portfolio, things that were highly correlated to equities and things that were highly correlated to bonds that were moving against each other for a decade. And now with them all moving together, this is where you have the problem, where it feels like everything is a correlation of one. Long-winded way of saying, as an allocator, if you want to get diversification bang for the buck, you have to start looking for things that have no correlation to either stocks or bonds. So to me, the top of the list, and this is a very, very self-serving statement, is I personally have not found a more valuable liquid diversifier than managed futures. Because during that two-year period of time, when everything else was going down, managed futures was going up. By the way, it's commodities and managed futures over the past 2 years. And if you look at these charts that I posted, it shows this. In 2022, commodities and managed futures go up, everything goes down. 2023, commodities and managed futures are down a little bit, everything else is up. But if you look at that two-year period, managed futures and commodities did much better. I mean, the S&P, right, was down until the last 2 months of the year. Bonds are still down 8 or 10% from the beginning of 2022. So from a diversification perspective, if your goal is to maximize your Sharpe ratio over time, to have a smoother ride, to, you know, help your clients in 20 years be able to see a path to increasing their assets and sleep at night, then I think that's where you start. You've got to start with things that have no correlation to either stocks or bonds.
Yeah, it's interesting on that point. We run a version of the permanent portfolio for our clients, and we were just doing some testing the other day, and we were looking at the standard permanent portfolio. And then we were looking at, instead of having the four assets in the standard portfolio, add a fifth with managed futures. It's better in every respect. The return is better. The risk stats are better. The drawdown is less. Like, it's amazing because managed futures are going up when other stuff's going down, and because they're fairly consistent, you know, it adds in a lot of ways to even something like the permanent portfolio, which is much more diversified than stocks and bonds.
If you have a statistical bone in your body, it's obvious, right? The challenge with managed futures is messaging. Why is it there? How do you explain it when it's down? You know, how do you explain? Because every other asset class is so much better at this, right? I was just with a friend at lunch who's a private equity guy. And I said, remember when they used to call you leverage buyouts? You know, who the hell was going to buy that, right? I mean, you could, but that wasn't going to go mainstream. Private equity sounds a lot better. You know, when I was at Baupost in the 1990s, we were doing lending transactions you call asset-based lending, hard money lending, all these things. Now it's private credit. You know, distressed debt, high-yield bonds, we used to be called junk bonds, right? So managed futures has a huge messaging problem because I can explain it to you guys and you guys can run the numbers and do it, but then you've got to explain it to other people. And managed futures is the worst term ever. So anyway, that's one of my projects of 2024 is basically, if this is something, for it to be useful for a typical advisor, it's not just about maximizing Sharpe ratio. Because I like to joke that I've never met anybody who hugged their financial advisor for raising their Sharpe ratio, right? It's you hug them because they protect your capital when you need it protected, and they make you more money over the time, and they do better than you would do for yourself. But what I think is, though, that I think a lot of the job of the wealth management business, you know, it's to keep clients invested. It's to keep them comfortable with what they have. It's allow them to go to live happily in the rest of their lives, feeling secure and feeling trust in their advisor. And the problem with a strategy like managed futures is it sounds scary. And it's not nearly as scary as it sounds, but you know, so I think if we fix that, and given what happened in 2022, 2023, in 5 years, it's not going to be whether you include the strategy in your portfolio. It's going to be there. The question is how much and how do you characterize the people? But we'll see.
You had mentioned stocks are one of the best ways to grow and compound wealth. And, you know, you might hear a statistic like over the long run, stocks have returned 10% annually and whatever with a 16% standard deviation. So what would be the comparable stat for, like, I know there's a lot of different managed futures strategies. So, but sort of the baseline managed futures strategy, what would be like the long-term CAGR and risk statistics, would you say?
Well, the last time I ran it, which was before a couple of months ago, if you looked at the long-term return, so the data on any hedge fund strategy starts to get really bad before you go through your early 2000s. They didn't have databases. They didn't have the things that you would expect to see. But if you look from 2000 forward, the returns are roughly between stocks and bonds. So depending upon, like, the S&P has done, if you do it internationally, it's actually as good as equities because equities haven't done as well. But if you do in the US, it's maybe 70% of the returns of stocks. So you're talking there. And then the key is it has zero correlation to both stocks and bonds over time, which is very unusual. And it does the best when you need it the most, right? Because when we think about these long-term asset allocation models, we kind of assume that, like, okay, if something has zero correlation, it's never going to move. Well, some of these things have positive correlation, negative correlation. You know, commodities in the early 2000s had negative correlation to equities and they had positive correlation. So, and the other thing is that it's not a very risky strategy, right? So to get that return for stocks, you have to endure these 40% drawdown. Then you come, you know, then you hold on to it with a white knuckle grip and you come climbing back. And then at 20% drawdown, you come back. Managed futures has a series of annoying 10% drawdowns, but not much more than that. And it's basically because the strategy is these guys in general, when trades start going against them, they don't care and they start to get out.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, it's the, whether it's because of how their model's configured, et cetera. So you, when you put that together, but I think the thing about managed futures is that, I think there are two questions. One is, why does it make sense, right? What is it doing that other people aren't doing? Almost everybody I know in the wealth management business, their job is to be the steady hand at the wheel, right? The perception is clients are the ones who are going to flip out in September of last year and want to sell everything because, again, they're down 20% across their portfolio. And if it goes down another 20% from here, and at that moment, by the way, everyone, you know, all the news is about inflation's going to 10%, the world is going to hell, equity's going to drop again from here. If it goes down another 20%, it has a really material impact on their lives. So selling at that point, I think people like to characterize it as an irrational decision. You know, they just, they don't have a long-term focus. I'm always a little skeptical of these kind of discussions of heuristic bias. I think they can get condescending very quickly. I think the reason sometimes people do it is because it is asymmetrical for them. You know, losing the next 10% is going to cause much more disruption in their lives than making back the next 10%. But if there's clearly an emotional component to it. But so what the wealth management community does incredibly well, I think, as we move toward model portfolios, like the permanent portfolio, is to get clients to focus on the overall picture, the long-term goals, and to keep them invested and have them confident in the plan between here and there. The limitation of that is sometimes the world changes faster. And if you're the steady hand at the wheel, you can't yank it to one side. When inflation started to come back in early 2022, the model guys that I know, they're not built to change it other than at the margin. They may sell some bonds, they may cut some duration here, but most guys, it's, you know, instead of being down 19%, they're trying to be down 18%. And so the thing about managed futures as a strategy, the reason it has this, you know, incredible source of alpha, these punctuated periods when it does so much better, is because it becomes the contrarian. In early 2022, it's seeing these signals in the market that inflation is coming back. It doesn't care that a year before that, it may have thought yields were going to keep going down. It doesn't have that kind of memory. So it changes position. It starts betting in a big way on inflation. And it can do so in a very, very, you know, direct pure play fashion. So the strategy goes up 20% last year. And so the way I think about it is not on a standalone basis, like, as you say, you know, is this a higher or lower Sharpe ratio than the other things that I have? Is what's the incremental benefit to, as a long-term investor, how do you think about this? How does this help you? And what I think it does is it adds more tactical flexibility, which more nimbleness. So when I think of managed futures, I haven't settled on a better name for it, but to me, it's opportunistic macro. You know, it's that there are, they get there through futures contracts, they get there through quantitative models, but the core underlying idea is every now and then nimbleness is really valuable. And so the strength of the wealth management industry by design is to be steady and move slowly in a thoughtful way so you don't pivot at the wrong time and get caught wrong-footed. On the other hand, that's why I think it could be additive.
How do you think about, when you were talking about that, it made me think about benchmarking. And you know, that's one of the big problems, I think, when you think about people putting managed futures in their personal portfolio, is the idea that I'm going to be at the cocktail party and I'm talking to the guy that's got the stocks and bonds and I'm going to look very different than him in certain years. And some years that's going to be better, and some years that's going to be worse. But like, when you manage your money, I mean, do you think about benchmarks at all? Or are you just thinking more about absolute returns?
So I don't think I would challenge that. I don't think you're going to be that different from the other guy at the cocktail party, right? If you're 20% in managed futures, right? And the cocktail party is in September 2022.
You're very happy.
You felt like a genius, right?
Yeah.
But again, but he's down 20, okay? With that 20% allocation, you're down 12, right? You're not up, right? You're not, it's lowering your drawdowns. The bounce back comes there, September of this year, well, not September, but December 31, you're having the same cocktail party. And he's talking about these windfall profits that he made in the last 8 weeks of the year. And he's underperformed by 300 basis points. You've underperformed him by 300 basis points. But so where I think the value of managed futures is, you know, people often ask me, how much should you put into managed futures? And everybody has a different business model. My recommendation is that it's probably sub 10% allocation. Because it's a sub 10% allocation because there are diminishing returns from a Sharpe ratio perspective from having an investment that's hard to explain. It's that simple, right? It's like, it's if your job is to keep your clients comfortable and invested with you over a long period of time. If last year you've got managed futures and you're up 20%, whether it's a 5% allocation or a 10% allocation, it doesn't make that much of a difference to their portfolio. They're still down, but they're down less. You point to it and you can say, we brought something of value that you wouldn't have otherwise found. It has helped you to weather a storm. Yes, the guys at Vanguard did, you know, and robo-advisors did worse than we did. But because of that, I think another key consideration, a practical consideration, is if you're running a wealth management business, it's hard to stray too far from your peers because they're waiting to pounce, right? They're waiting for that moment when something goes wrong in your portfolio and allocation and they can point to it. So I think it's all a balancing act. I think as I've gotten to know the wealth management business more, I think a lot of it is about these very human considerations of not just running the business, but helping clients to understand how these pieces fit together and why that's going to make them happier in 20 years and sleep better between now and then. And that's a gift, right? If you can give that to them.
So going back to the equity portion of your portfolio, you talked a little bit before about how you have over additional exposure to international right now.
Yeah.
What else do you do there? Like, can you just talk at a high level about how you think about constructing like that equity portion?
So, my general view is unless I have a very clear competitive advantage, I aim for average. So I start with kind of an ACWI-like exposure. And I'm overweight international stocks because of various accidents in tax loss harvesting and things I sold for various reasons. And the question was, do I go and rebalance from there? And it was about a 10-minute exercise in terms of, do I think it's worth it to rebalance, take a tax hit on international equities that I've owned for a very, very long time, to go into a different area, or am I pretty comfortable with what I'm getting? I looked at the overlap, I looked at the correlation, I looked at a number of things, and I was comfortable with it. So I'm sitting with it now. But again, I'm weird, right? I don't spend a lot of time thinking about it because my general sense is that, my general feeling is that, and I'll give you a little more like history on it. When I started business in 1990. I started as an M&A investment banker. The U.S. business world was very different back then. You go back to the 1980s, why did LBOs happen? Right? I mean, because there were tons and tons of terribly run companies. Right? Why was the value factor a thing? Because there were sleepy companies with lots of assets, terrible management teams, sleepy boards, and no one was really paying attention to it. And so these things would get so cheap and so unloved that they outperformed over time. By the time 1990 rolls around, those companies are all gone. Because smart people, once people had access to financing from junk bonds, they realized, well, things trading at 50 cents on the dollar, I can pay 70 cents on the dollar and pay a 40% premium, take it private, and I'm still cheap relative to the value of the business. And it's got so many assets sitting around, I could probably pay down my debt from that. Right? So the market took care of the value factor in a very real way. Now, but still by 1990, you do an analysis of an industry. You have a few great companies, a lot of lousy companies that are waiting to get taken over, bought out, or going to go out of business, and a bunch of middling companies. This was a period of time when you point to like, wait, they built another factory. They haven't made money on the other four factories that they have. Oh, I'm sorry. It's in the hometown of one of the board members, right? It was a different one. Since then, what the LBO business kicked off was, remember greed is good in Wall Street?
Greed.
Controversial. You know, like, oh my God, you know, put the interests of shareholders above everybody else. How horrible, how crazy. That was the coming out of the 1970s and early 1980s. By the end of the 1990s, it's standard, right? And I mean, the whole ESG thing has muddied the waters a bit, but for a very, very long period of time, it was crystal clear. You're the CEO of a company, increase your return on capital, get money back to shareholders unless you have good things to do with it. We're giving you options, which gives you a huge incentive to get your stock price up. And companies got more efficient across the board. And if you didn't adopt that stuff, you were bought, you were torn apart, you were restructured, et cetera. So to me, the average publicly traded company today is pretty great. Now go back to the early 1990s. If you were a stock picker, you really could pick winners and losers in industry. You were the one making the capital allocation decisions. You know, either you're a value guy saying this terrible company can't get any worse, they're going to come back. You know, you're a hedge fund who says, this terrible company brought in a new CEO, he's going to clean it up and change it. Okay, now that's an event-driven situation. The market's got ahead of this company. It's going to fall back down to earth. It's going to revert to the mean. A lot of those stock picking decisions were pushed down to the CEO level, because the CEOs were now the one who were saying, what do we do with our next dollar of capital? Concepts like return on invested capital were alien concepts in the 1980s. 10 years later, everyone is using them. EBITDA was a term that you had to explain to people slowly in 1990. People didn't have Lotus. I was using Lotus 1-2-3 on big, stupid looking computers, right? Now there's no question about cash flow, free cash flow, all these other things. So to me, we try to think about these things historically, but just when I look at the way the corporate public ownership is structured today, and the same with private equity, you've got the same thing happening. The wind is at your back to make money over time. And you're entrusting that the people who are running these companies were the right people, and they're going to figure out the right decisions to make over time. And they've, just like a fund manager who has all of his money tied up in his own fund, these guys have an equally strong incentive to get it right. And that's what Warren Buffett said. But they asked, because Warren Buffett said, what would you do with your money? He said, I put 95% into the S&P 500, 5% into cash, and not look at it. And sometime later, somebody said, well, you know, but isn't that passive? It's not passive. You've got 500 hungry CEOs who go to work every day who are working for me to try to find ways to make me money, because if they make me money, they make themselves money. So I think that's true in Europe, maybe not so much in emerging markets where you have much more crazy governmental stuff. When you get government involved in different ways, it tends to cloud the picture. The ESG is clouded the picture. But in general, I think the only knock on the U.S. equity markets, and I mean, look at the companies, Microsoft, Alphabet, you know, I mean, these are the greatest companies ever invented, run by this. I mean, when I started, it was, we can't get smart people to work outside of investment banking. Guess where the smart people are now?
Yeah, not in investment banking.
No, they are. I mean, the brains in a place like Google, you know, is just, and they are hungry, rapacious capitalists. So again, so my, you know, my sort of big Uber view is that in general, being invested equities is not passive. You know, it's your own, you own companies, you own minuscule stakes in companies, and you're betting that these guys will do it. The issues in the US and in general is that valuations are really high. People have figured this out. And so we could see 10 years of very, very low returns in the S&P. We could see, it's a little bizarre that a handful of companies constitute so much of the value. But on the other hand, look at what they're doing. Look at AI. I mean, they're building new businesses, new industries overnight.
Do you make that whole idea of 10 years where we could see below average returns, do you make any changes to your portfolio because of that? Do you say, like, I want to de-risk or something like that? Or do you just kind of say, I can't time this, you know, let's just let that portion of it ride and let's just go with it?
The moment I de-risk is the moment we have a melt-up. I've studied it. There's a perfect, if I tweet that something is bad, buy it. Okay? It's like, no, look, I, you know, I grew up in a world in the hedge fund industry where people are really humble. I mean, it's people, the best guys that I talk to in the hedge fund and the private equity industry spend much more time talking about things where they got nailed. And I, you know, one of the first conversations I had with Seth Klarman about this, and I didn't know anything about investing when I joined, really. I've been an investment banker. I'd worked briefly for a guy named Tom Lee, rest in peace, when I was at business school. And Seth gave a story about this, you know, at the time he was like, you know, considered one of the great short sellers, a guy named Jim Chanos. And Chanos goes to some corporate annual meeting. And this is like when people would actually show up to, you know, like at physical in person annual meetings to grill management, et cetera. And he gets up, he grabs the mic and he gives this long talk about management's doing this. It's terrible. You're not doing the right job, you know, whatever. And they say, are you done? I said, yeah, we'd like to announce a takeover. And so you can get, you know, you can know a company backwards and forward and still get slammed. And so my general view is that I've got no edge. You know, there are people who I think are great on the asset allocation side. They have a little bit of an edge. But my time is really spent. My time is best spent trying to grow my private business. You know, an hour spent trying to grow my private business is going to be much more valuable incrementally than an hour trying to figure out whether international stocks are going to outperform U.S. stocks over the next 10 years, because I won't get it right.
So your thoughts on bonds earlier were not that positive. Do you just avoid them altogether? Like, do you not own bonds, or do you have like a small sleeve of bonds, or how do you think about that?
Well, so because the bonds have two pieces, right? You've got the interest rate piece, then you've got the credit piece, right? The credit piece is the more credit you have, the more it looks like equities. So people love bonds for non-economic reasons. Oh, it shows up, money shows up in my account every quarter. Okay. That's great. Okay. But that's not an economic decision. That's a, you know, that's a feeling of comfort that you get from seeing your checking account go up. It feels safe. Right. So, when interest rates got as low as they did, it became pretty clear to me. Again, I don't mind I will make market calls, but it's got to be at a point of extremes, right? When I see people buying 10-year AA rated corporate bonds, and when I read the document on it and I see no protections for lenders, because it's to a private equity owned company that is much smarter than lenders and has stripped out all the protections you would get. And I look at the underlying assets and think, if this thing, you know, if these things go bust, the recovery is going to be 20 cents on the dollar. Yeah, then to me, the answer is don't own any bonds. Because, but you're at the end of a 20-year crazy bull market. I mean, we had $18 trillion of negative yielding bonds in this world at one point, right? You only own them if you, or if you think deflation is coming and the world is going to hell and it's going to zero. So today, bonds are obviously much more attractive than they were. But are they more attractive than equities? If the correlation, now my belief, and I could be proven utterly wrong, and the fact that I'm saying it out loud means, you know, correlations are probably going to invert tomorrow. But my belief is that stock and bond correlations are likely to remain positive for the next decade. How do I support that? It's nothing more complicated than if you look at stocks and bonds over very, very long periods of time, most of the time they're positively correlated. The 2000 to 2010s were a very, very unusual period. So I tend to believe that history matters. There are some academic and other arguments for it, but it's certainly what we saw in 2022 and 2023. What do you think was the correlation between the S&P 500 and the Bloomberg Ag in 2023?
Was it I don't know, like 0.8 or 0.9? I'm guessing, I don't know, something like
0.84.
that.
0.84.
Okay.
Right? So it says you nailed it, right? But so think of that though, right? I'm taking money from equities, which I can look at over, unless I think equities are going to drop in half or every, you know, but so I'm looking at equities. most of my risk in bonds is going to be credit, unless I'm buying treasuries. So I'm assuming we're talking about credit instruments. That risk overlaps a lot with my equity exposure, and I expect to make more money over here over time. This will obviously be less volatile than this. But from a diversification perspective, if they're moving in tandem, I'm going from something where I'm getting a dollar of risk, and I'm adding, and I'm taking where I can get a dollar of risk and a dollar of return, and I'm adding it to something where I'm getting 30 cents of returns, 50 cents of returns, but 50% of risk. I don't see how that's necessarily value added. Now, on the other hand, I would say also say that when I look at the world today, I'm struck by not just the frequency with which macro strategists have been wrong, but by the magnitude. And so I was asked a couple of months ago, what would be a crazy prediction for 2024? We could have deflation back again. Like we were so wrong on inflation coming back that what the underlying drivers of it, the impact of all this disruptive innovation that's happening, the structural changes in the economy. I personally think inflation's going to be tough to put back in the bottle in the way people think it's going to be too easy. But I didn't also expect it to come out down as much as it has. But my reasoning around it is kind of simple. I think spending's addictive. You know, it's much easier when you get checks coming in for the government during COVID to decide you want to add an extra vacation than it is to make the decision to cut the vacation next year. You know, you're going to hope that something's going to come back, something's going to improve. And so, look, I think the government hasn't shown, no one in the U.S. government seems to show any real inclination to cut the budget. The whole debate is, the budget deficit, we grow it a little more slowly. So, you know, I think so my guess is stock and bond correlations remain positive over time. And on the basis of that assumption, if I had to pick between stocks and bonds, I would pick stocks.
In a world where they're positively correlated like that, I could think like two different ways to approach something like gold and commodities. You know, one way is obviously if I've already got a managed futures position, which you do, that'll handle it for me. The other side is like, I should actually have direct exposure to gold and commodities outside of that. Like, how do you think about that?
I think you have both. I think Robert Samuelson, the Nobel laureate, had one of the great quotes where he said, diversification is the one true free law. Diversification, or in finance, diversification is the one true free lunch or something, right? If you have the magic of having two things that are non-correlated is your risk goes down more than your returns going down. Going back to the kind of humility argument, you know, we could have gold soaring for the next 5 years and managed futures not doing much, or vice versa. 2022 was a shocker, because gold didn't do much. You know, so how could gold not move when inflation comes back? Again, my general thing is, because it's hard to really pick winners that carefully, I think that diversification is very valuable.
So are we missing anything else, like any private real estate, any stakes in other companies within the overall, personal sort of portfolio side of things, before we move on to a couple other things here?
I have small interests in diversified private equity fund of funds. But it was a decision that was made by an advisor that I didn't feel strongly about either way. Private equity is, private equity and private credit, are almost like the Frankenstein monsters of the allocation world, right? These have become institutional asset classes. Private equity is equities, right? It's just a different form. So if you're going to go from publicly traded equities that are liquid, tax efficient, cheap, et cetera, to private equity, which is illiquid, expensive, and you have to invest in a very, very chunky way, you have to be confident that these guys are going to add an awful lot of value relative to the public markets. Now, on the private credit side, part of the reason private credit took off was because the firms that were doing it in the early 2010s had the world to themselves. And everything was cheap because we're coming out of the GFC. So, you know, they could buy, you know, there were structured credit bonds that private credit firms, which again, were also investing, not just issuing new loans, but, you know, you could buy them at a, when interest rates were zero, close to zero, you could buy them at a 12% unleveraged yield. They had the market to themselves. There was 1/10 of the capital they have today. Like all things, when you have something that's great, more money flows into it. So over time, the returns came down. Now they stopped talking about unleveraged returns. They started leveraging those returns to get them back up. So, you know, in general, I think when you're evaluating any of these things, you should have a very, very, very high bar to move into them. Now, a lot of the private equity world is part of the appeal of it. Again, is non-economic. If you're an institutional investor and you're investing in private equity funds, it's the lightest job in the world. Don't shoot me, guys. But you basically make a call that you like this KKR fund. You're done with that for the next 10 years. You can't change your mind, right? You're going to have to give the money when they ask for the money, etc. So your whole job is you make a series of these decisions and then you just kind of watch how it plays out. Now, the institutions love it, because they can pretend they're not risky because they don't go up and down like everything else. Cliff Asness, I think, has called this not a bug, but a feature of the strategies. And the thing about the, so, you know, when you talk about the fact that you don't mark private equity and private credit has the same issue as well, it's, you know, people have often described it as like, oh, the asset managers have somehow tricked, you know, these institutional investors and pension plans. It's not a trick. Nobody wants it more than the pension plans. And I've talked to my friends in the private equity space. I'm like, guys, do you really think you weren't down that much in 2022? And they're like, look, we don't really care what our marks are. But if we mark them down, our clients get pissed at us. And if we don't mark it up when something good happens, our clients get pissed at us. Because what the clients want, what that allocator wants, is to go to his investing committee and say, you know, the S&P was down 20%. And we barely budged. We're geniuses. But I think as an investor, the reason I did these or a lot of it is because they tend to be more esoteric. You know, they're not big private equity funds. It's some guy who's doing, you know, trying to buy healthcare royalties, some guy who's doing this and, you know, off the run real estate, things that I would never, you know, be interested in or see. I believe that, you know, I do believe that investing in smaller managers is a much better way to make money in those spaces in particular, because you can focus on, like when I was at Baupost, the most interesting things that I found to do were the ones we couldn't put enough money into. And so, you know, I was the guy who would spend like 6 months looking at something and then claim victory because we could put a few million dollars into it. But I think that is where the value, if you're going to invest in space, that is where the value is. But as an advisor, or as a fiduciary, it can be very hard to do that because if something goes wrong, you're much more likely to be blamed. If something goes wrong with the biggest funds, it's everybody's problem. If something goes wrong with your fund, it's your problem. So there, but that's also part of the opportunity. You want to put money in places where there are structural limitations where people can't invest.
Did you have the other hedge funds that you were co-founded and you've been part of in your career? I think going back maybe like 25 years or however long, were those funds actually purchased or bought? Were there liquidity events for you?
Yeah. So I sold, there was one I started in the commodity space I sold out the stake in two transactions in the late 2000s. So basically the way I interacted with them, I ended up founding them. I ended up kind of bringing in the people, building the business plan, raising a lot of the initial money. And once the birds got aloft, I kind of left them to the management teams and retained an equity interest. At some point they'd gotten big enough that I ended up, one of them I ended up selling. The other one had a great 2008, but we had weak-handed investors like Swiss private banks and you know, family offices and others who were desperate to get money for anywhere they could. And so we waived all of our redemption provisions to allow people to get their money because we're like, it's your money. we could hold it for 90 days, but you seem to really need it in December of 2008 because you're investing in muni bonds and all of a sudden you can't sell your muni bonds. It's causing all these cascading liquidity issues. So basically about 70% of our assets went out the door in a few months and most of it never came back. So that business ended up dying the old fashioned way of atrophy.
Okay. But you had, one pretty decent sized success. And I'm just kind of wondering, like, if you were to give yourself advice from today back then in terms of coming into, a buyout in substantial wealth, what advice would you give your younger self? Because I think that's a big thing when it happens the first time. Like, someone's never seen that type of, maybe you reinvested it right into the next business. I don't know, but I'm wondering like how you sort of approached that and handled that and what you learned from going through that experience.
So I did, I'm a terrible example because money has never been nearly as important to me as it should be. I started a school. I single-handedly started a school with my ex-wife. I bought the building, I funded it, I hired the teachers. I paid for probably 24 socially economically advantaged kids to go through a 12 through K through 12 education. You guys may know this from Connecticut, but it's based in Westport.
The Pierpont School?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I plowed it back into businesses. I think there's always, the advice that I would have given, that I would give to a normal person in this, which I don't think I'm normal, because look, I could be a monk. Like, I can live in completely different, I could become a teacher tomorrow. I wasn't one of these guys who was designed to go into the investment management industry, like at age 12, thinking about where I was going to get a summer job. I mean, I sort of fell into it as I was graduating from college, because I thought I knew a lot of smart, interesting people who were doing it. And then I got very excited about it, and I've been doing it ever since. But the recommendation that I would give is basically come up with a plan, find guys like you, give them your money, and let them do their jobs. Let them grow your wealth. That people tinker too much. I know a lot of family offices, and the way they've done really well is they've got a core part of the portfolio, 90-95% of the portfolio, that is just straightforward and standard. And there's a part of it that I would call play money. It's the fun stuff. We just made a venture capital investment in a company that's going to solve Alzheimer's. Didn't you just invest like 3 years ago in a company that was going to solve Alzheimer's? but it doesn't, it's not at a scale that it changes things, because the most valuable lesson you can learn is the value of compounding. Is compound, and think in terms of, just do the math in your head. Do a 5% return for the next 30 or 40 years. Bump it to 6%. Take it down to 1%. Cut it in half because you're taking doing something stupid like starting a school. Like, those long-term effects compound over time. First guy that I worked for, Seth Klarman, one of the reasons the guy's a multi-billionaire today is because it was just in his wiring. Everything to him was, first of all, he was one of these people he's freakishly smart, who could naturally compound numbers out 20 years. But the guy goes to buy a cup of coffee and he wants the latte. Damn it, he's not going to buy the latte because it's cheaper to get the coffee and add the milk. Even if it doesn't taste quite as good. Because I know in his head, he's like, that's $1.50. That's $72,438 in 50 years. And that's Buffett, right? These guys who just think in those terms. And that then for these guys becomes a life decision, that it affects how they spend, how they think about things. It becomes their overall philosophy of life. For whatever reasons, I didn't have that wiring.
Yeah, well, I think it's it, but it's a very cool and amazing thing that, you know, it wasn't like you had the liquidity event, you gave them $100,000 donation and then walked away. I mean, you were involved in that school and maybe you still are. I'm not sure.
I'm not anymore. Yeah. A divorce will very quickly get you to figure out which where you belong and where you don't. My wife, sort of ex-wife, ran the school for a long time, but I was very active as the head of the board of the school early on. And it was a great pleasure. I mean, the teachers that we had were absolutely incredible. It's things like that I would never regret. I mean, at one point I went on the board of UNICEF. I gave them money, because I just thought, how much is an incremental dollar to me versus an incremental dollar to a kid where $300 can take in a malnourished 4-year-old and get them back to health in 9 months. You know, just and I got involved. The team was great and I ended up working with them to try to find a way to work with a financial institution to accelerate supplies to places in the world that need it the most. The first guy that I worked for was a guy named Jim Wolfenson, who was ended up becoming chairman of the World Bank. He was this incredible guy, this renaissance man in the business world. And one of the pieces of advice he gave me was, like, don't wait to get involved. Don't wait to be chair. You know, don't become the guy who does nothing and then at age 60 you decide you want to, you know, gift money to your alma mater or something. He said, find a way to be involved and do things throughout your life. And I've tried to do that over time. And sometimes it's costly and sometimes it's economically destructive, but I've just never had that wiring of trying to maximize wealth. And I think it comes from, you know, my mother grew up in a very, like her father, my grandfather in the 1950s was one of the wealthier people in the country. And you look at her childhood photos, you're like, is that Eisenhower on the, like flipping burgers, or is that Princess Grace in the pool? I mean, she lived a crazy life. But she was also a radical. Like the last 20 years of her life, she was working in AIDS and methadone clinics in the South Bronx area, and she was living in a tiny apartment. That's where she drew value. And so I do have part of that in me. It's not, you know, and I'm remarried now, and my wife is somebody who has both feet on the ground. And I think that's a non-economic decision, but it's the most important one. Now, having money to help you live in peace of mind, because if you don't have it, if you don't have some stability, it's, you know, you don't even have time to think about these things because you're just scrambling day to day to make it through stuff. So it is such a privilege to not have to worry day to day about the next meal. But on the other hand, if you spend all of your time worrying about money and value maximization, again, for me, I don't think that's necessarily the right answer either.
That idea of don't wait, and this kind of gets into my question I'm going to ask, but that idea of don't wait made me think about Bill Perkins' Die with Zero, because he kind of, I don't know if you know that book.
I've heard of it. I haven't read the book.
Okay. But yeah, he has the same idea, which is basically people tend to wait, not just to give to charity, but people tend to wait to do things they want to do in their lives. And then they get to be retired when they can't do any of it. And they've got all this money to do it. So it's like people get it a little bit wrong sometimes in life in terms of not doing the things now and like always saving for the future.
One of my friends was mocking me. So I have a friend who's a billionaire. He said, you did it wrong. Don't give away your money till you're a billionaire. It's like you did it backwards. Right. But look, I never regret for a second. I wish more people thought like that. You know, I think what Buffett did and Bill Gates, what those guys started. I mean, we are going to have, think of something like the Rockefeller Foundation. It's child's play compared to what Buffett and Bill Gates, you know, I had the pleasure of working with the Bill Gates Foundation when I was on UNICEF. And people criticize Bill Gates and whatever the political side of whatever. The guy's incredible. He has turned his mind that made Microsoft into trying to solve the world's problems. And whether you think he's doing it the right way or not, a critical issue in like the nonprofit space, for instance, is you don't have Bill Gateses. You know, that's not where a Bill Gates at age 18 or 19 or 20 is thinking, I'm going to go run a nonprofit. But the fact that he's doing it now, the fact that Brad Buffett says, you know, this is the goat of charitable giving. Like I remember on the education side, after I started the school, I kept getting asked to, you know, participate in these panels and stuff in education. And I was talking to somebody at the Gates Foundation, and they had done this multi-year study to try to figure out, okay, let's try to, people talk about small class sizes being better. Let's test it. What is the most rigorous, scientific, well-funded way to do it? And they did it. And they set up these small labs all over the place, smaller class sizes. They had controls, they compared it to whatever. And 3 or 4 years later, they realized it didn't work. They put like $1 billion into it. They killed it. They'd reach enough and they stopped. Like that kind of rigorous thinking is so desperately needed in the nonprofit world. And so when you look at these people with their fortunes and what they're going to do, this guy named John Arnold in Texas, who we had the pleasure of investing in one of the businesses, one of the greatest traders you could possibly come across, was worth a couple $1 billion, you know, probably by the time he was 35. You know, that guy is turning his attention to trying to solve real societal problems. So whether they give it away or they hold the foundation or how they do it, it's, I think that charitable ethos is something that will really change America in the next 20 years.
So we have a couple more questions we always like to ask at the end here. And this is kind of cool because usually with these interviews, we've talked about, you know, stocks and bonds and stuff the entire time. We never get to this. We've actually covered a lot of this already. No, this is actually great because it's good to think about what money actually means a lot rather than just thinking about money. So I like to ask this question at the end where I talk about like something that you do that maybe is a good investment for you personally, but is not a good investment financially. And the example I always give is, you know, I have a racing sailboat somewhere close to where you used to live. And you know, that's a terrible investment. It's, you know, you have to always constantly put money into it, but every Wednesday night I can go out with my friends. I can have a beer. We have fun with it. Like I can get so much personal value out of it. And I'm wondering if you have anything like that in your life, whether it's trips or something like that, where maybe it's a terrible investment, but you know, it really is great and beneficial for you.
Sure. So I would say, first of all, I define a terrible investment in two ways, right? One is it bad economically? And is it bad in terms of my time? Right. And so one of the lessons I took away, I've had businesses that didn't succeed as well as the ones that I have, but with all of them, I tried to kill them fast because I would see these family offices who would invest in something, small investment, 2% of their portfolio, and it's 30% of their time, trying to figure out what to do with it. So to me, the classic example is home ownership. If you have a modicum of financial security, which I'm lucky to have, there are great benefits to homeownership. First of all, I'm a terrible home buyer, right? I buy homes at the wrong time because, you know, I was looking for a place to, in my first marriage, looking at a place to establish my family, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they're also really burdensome. They require a lot of work. Time and attention and things like that. Some people derive pleasure from that. You know, let's put on the tool belt and let's go figure things out. I'm replaning this or I'm doing that. I don't. I grew up in an apartment in New York City. Like my sense of homeownership is you call the super, right? And so to me, a decision that I've made to try to be smarter over time, just in terms of time and everything else, is for the foreseeable future, I'll rent. I'm perfectly happy renting. It's more flexible. It may not be economically as sensible as buying a home that's going to appreciate in value tax-free. That is, you know, is a store of wealth in a way. So I may lose on the economic side, but what I gain on flexibility and peace of mind is valuable. And I'll just tell you sort of another sort of analogy. Is I'm sitting in a WeWork space in New York right now, right? We were looking at getting new office space about 5 years ago. And if you get office space in New York, you know, it's a 10-year lease. You put up security deposits. It's inflexible and all these other things. WeWorks is an atmospheric step down by a big step down relative to having your own office, which I've always had before this. But the flexibility, we can shrink, we can grow, we can shrink, we can, you know, we can move from this building to another building. It's really valuable for us in terms of, so to me, I think flexibility and peace of mind are non-economic considerations that in this case outweighs what would probably be a more sensible economic decision, which would be to find a house that I really like. I want to be in for 10 years. Because every time I would buy and sell houses, I was always think like, I'm going to be there for 10 years or 20 years. And most of the time, I'd be selling them and I'm paying a 5% commission on the way in and a 5% commission on the way out. So to me, home ownership is the big one.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like, that's been so programmed into us that you have to like own a home. But like, if you take a step back and you think about it, I mean, a lot of people, it still makes tons of sense to own a home. But absolutely, for some other people, it doesn't. Like, you know, I'm thinking right now with those projects in the tool belt, like I'm thinking about the stuff I have to go do in my house. Like, I got to paint the basement. I got to do all this stuff. And I'm like, do I really want to do that? Or would it be better if I just, you know, rented a house sometimes? But I mean, I'll probably still own homes, but it is true. Like, if you actually just looked at it at first principles, you know, and you didn't just think, well, I got to own a home, you know, a lot of people would probably make a different decision.
So look, I think my wife would feel differently. She would never want an extravagant home because she doesn't want the burden of it. She doesn't want, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, she grew up, you know, she's an immigrant who grew up very poor. You know, the security of owning a house for her is very tangible. She does own a small house, and I think she derives great comfort from that. I look at it and think it's an old house that requires a lot of work. It's a constant headache, and so it's just a difference. I'll tell you sort of a funny story. Well, not funny, but a nice anecdote about Eisenhower. Incredibly organized. Yeah. And he would sit down every morning, very, very methodically, and write down a list of things he had to do. And he'd go down the top five and cross out everything else. And basically, if it wasn't in the top five, he wouldn't even try to do it. And I've tried to adopt more of that. Like, I know what I want my day to be like. I wake up at 3 or 4 in the morning, right? My partner's in Paris. I can work from then until dinner, like doing stuff like this, staring at a computer, doing et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, when I lift my head up from it, I've got different priorities. I've got a 2-year-old son, right? An hour spent with him is infinitely more valuable than an hour spent doing anything else. I want to spend time with my wife. Like, so it's trying to think about how these economic decisions play into the rest of your life. But I also have the luxury of you know, of having it's a great luxury to be able to make a lot of those decisions for yourself, which doesn't apply to a lot of people, but it's I've learned to try to think really hard about priorities and making it all fit together.
Well, now I know I'm going to tell my wife that I'm taking the Eisenhower approach to the home improvement projects. We're going to pick at the top five where everything else has got to go. It's not going to go well, but I may take a shot at it. So as we wrap up, we always have a standard closing question on these, which is if you had to impart one lesson you've learned from building your portfolio to the average investor, what would that be?
Think long term. You know, it goes back to the compounding question. It's, you know, I mean, just do the basic math. Like I was reading about a hedge fund the other day, and it was guys who were thinking in college, I save $1,000 this semester and I invest it. How much could it be worth in 40 years? Right? And so if you're working and you're 25 years old or 30 years old and have a job, and just think of those terms, putting a little bit away, saving a little bit. It's interesting. It's something they said at Harvard Business School. They said, you have to, from day one, find a way to save a little bit and start accumulating wealth, because it will be working for you on the side. And I've done that in a very, very weird way, right? Because I started in a different place, my jobs have been very different, the business that I've ended up pursuing. But I think that's, at some point you're going to be 55 or 65 or retire. And at that point, you know, you're not going to have the flexibility to move the next job that you want to move. Even if you're 55 today, it's a lot harder to move than if you're 35. So think long-term, be patient, you know, trust that people who are running companies are trying to build value over time. Policymakers in general, you know, big, maybe quotation marks or something, are trying to find ways for the economy to grow over time or for there to be more wealth accumulation. So long-term, you know, try to be very optimistic and have a long-term plan that you can execute.
That's great. Well, thank you so much for coming back on. We really appreciate you giving us all the time. If people want to learn more about you or your business, where can they go?
So first of all, definitely reach out to me on LinkedIn. I'm easy to find. I post a lot of stuff on LinkedIn that you may just find interesting. I'm also on Twitter if you're still bouncing around that area, but I'm not on as much because it was giving me a headache. But also, we have a website called, it's www.dbi.co, no M. And we publish our research and other stuff on it. So if you're interested in the stuff that we're doing, that's where you can find it.
Well, thank you, Andrew. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Jack. It's wonderful being on again. So have a wonderful day.
This is Justin again. Thanks so much for tuning into this episode of Excess Returns. You can follow Jack on Twitter at @practicalquant and follow me on Twitter at JJ Carboneau. If you found this discussion interesting and valuable, please subscribe in either iTunes or on YouTube, or leave a review or a comment. We appreciate it.
Justin Carboneau and Jack Forehand are principals at Validia Capital Management. The opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Validia Capital. No information on this podcast should be construed as investment advice. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of clients of Validia Capital.